Welcome to this week's episode of Guftagu, an LSE Beaver podcast series in collaboration with the Pakistan Society. Guftagu means conversation in Urdu, and this series will feature candid conversations regarding South Asian social issues, culture, and identity. This episode is the first installment of Guftagu's monthly series on climate change in South Asia, featuring climate experts and activists from around the region. This week, I will be joined by Ahmed Rafi Alam, an environmental lawyer and climate activist based in Pakistan, whose work focuses on the country's environmental issues, natural resources, and urban development. Hello, Mr. Rafi. Thank you so much for joining us. It is a pleasure to be speaking with you today.
Thank you for having me.
So, sir, your expertise is around legal and regulatory work. You're a lawyer. And since we've sat down today to discuss Pakistan's environmental issues, I'm going to rewind to the year 2013 when you formed your own company. And your company, essentially, you can explain to us more about, was a legal and consulting body that focused on environment-related issues, natural resources, and urban development. To start off our interview, I wanted to ask you what it was about these specific sectors that made you want to work exclusively in this field, and generally what it is about Pakistan's climate crisis that makes you so passionate about the cause.
Well, thank you for asking a very interesting question. I became a lawyer because I felt that I could help people, and spent the first, you could say, close to 10 years of my career essentially making rich people richer. I did a lot of corporate and commercial practice. It's what I focused on, as a matter of fact. And somewhere along the line, I remember a senior lawyer, Mehmood Manviwala, in fact, told me a lesson about his own experience. He said, to be a successful lawyer in Pakistan, first, you have to specialize in something. That was around about the time I had had an experience working with civil society in Lahore against a proposed infrastructure development, which we felt was not good for the environment. It involved widening the road instead of widening a road rather than investing in public transport. And I had discovered through that bit of activism that there was environmental law in Pakistan, and we used it relatively effectively in that case. And it occurred to me that this could be my specialization of sorts. It was a subject that was close to my heart because it involved, well, the activism was a subject close to my heart because it involved the city of Lahore in its history and its urban planning. And I was interested in these subjects and had discovered through this experience that not only did we have an environmental law, but we had legislations and various rules and regulations in place that actually envisaged and set out how our city should function, so that there was even an urban planning law, so to speak. And this developed as an interest, really. And I figured at that time that one could even specialize in it. Decided that perhaps environmental law, because it's a growing field, would be something that I could specialize in and distinguish myself from the millions of other banking and corporate lawyers, ambitious banking and corporate lawyers that are in the market. Then about 2013, a friend of mine and I decided that we would have a law firm that would focus on these issues rather than providing general practice or general advice.
You mentioned the city of Lahore and how close it is to your heart. I live in Islamabad, but I was born in Lahore and I frequently visit. And I think, to jump into our next question, once you enter Lahore, it's almost like every time you visit, you feel that there are more people. And it's quite obvious that our main cities are endlessly expanding and the pressure on them is constantly increasing. And this, of course, I feel has implications for the environment and the well-being of these cities. And so about that, I wanted to ask you, in the next couple of years, what do you think are our main city's biggest environmental challenges? And in what ways are the city's current infrastructures not equipped to deal with these pressures?
Yeah, well, fantastic. Now, there are two ways of looking at a city, and they provide different approaches on how you can try and fix a city's problems. The first is to consider what happens in a city, and then look at those areas and provide services that can cater to those areas that the city, so for example, a city can provide housing, a city should provide employment, a city should provide education, city should provide sanitation and sewerage. It's very crucial because otherwise you can't have large numbers of people living. It should provide healthcare facilities. It should provide recreational facilities, obviously, because people are human beings at the end of the day, are not just automatons that go from home to work and back again. So if you look at the city in these sort of terms, and what a city provides people, it helps you understand the various areas of services that a city must also provide its citizens. Another way of looking at cities is by appreciating that cities are a unique output of human civilization. No other animal on earth creates cities. You know, humans are unique. And in many ways, it is a defining characteristic of our species. All sorts of good comes out of cities. Cities is where trade takes place. Cities are where quite often governments are. Cities are where religion takes place. Cities are where ideas take place. But at the same time, cities are also the worst of humanity because they showcase incredible inequalities. And in cities that don't provide the basic services that I was just talking about, if you don't have clean drinking water, if you don't have adequate sanitation or housing, cities can become places of human squalor. When we think about Pakistani cities are mired by bad governance. You'd be surprised that very few Pakistani cities have elected mayors in their history or even today. There's almost no democratic participation in decision-making in our cities. Decision-making is usually governed more centrally through provincial headquarters or the federal capital in some instances. And this essentially deprives, this is an attempt by governments to control the services that a city has, but quite often a means of forgetting that citizens and human beings are the center of this equation, and it's their view and their voice that needs to be heard when planning and developing a city. The environmental challenges that grow out of mismanagement, especially nowadays, given Pakistan cities' populations, focus almost entirely on sanitation and clean water. There is, because cities have grown so fast, so quickly, that infrastructure has not been able to keep up with population growth. People have been forced to build homes without any planning, what we often call kachi abadis, and then fight for public utilities like water and gas and so on and so forth. And it takes decades then for the state or the local administration to be able to move their infrastructure to adapt to the new people living in these places. So Pakistani cities lag behind in providing services because they've been growing so fast. And the reasons for this are manifold. Bad governance, the fact that cities don't make much money, and don't have much cash to be able to invest in the infrastructure that their citizens need. Pakistan is a poor country after all. And all of these things combined make cities incredibly ungovernable and uninhabitable sometimes. That said, I do also want to point out that Pakistani cities, no two Pakistani cities are the same. And what I do want to point out is that Pakistan is home to some of the world's largest cities, but also a number of what we refer to as secondary or tertiary cities, satellite cities, smaller cities. So the large megalopolises like Karachi and Lahore, with populations of over 20 million or 10 million, respectively in this case, have environmental and governance problems which seem almost insurmountable. Take, for example, the case of Lahore that produces 6,000 tons of waste a day. 6,000 tons a day. The logistical nightmare of being able to collect that much trash and being able to dispose of it in a sanitary way at a landfill involves over 13,000 people, several thousand trucks operating in two shifts to be able to keep the streets of the city clean. But that is very different from managing a city like Sialkot, for instance, where the daily output of trash probably isn't more than 300 or 400 tons, which would only require several hundred people and a half a dozen trucks and probably one shift a day to be able to resolve. So while Pakistani cities do suffer from environmental problems, I don't think we should use cities like Islamabad, Lahore, and Karachi as an indicator of how challenging the resolution of these environmental problems are. It's my firm belief that Pakistan's secondary and tertiary cities are still manageable. They haven't popped at the seams like Karachi and Lahore. They still have populations that can be catered to with relatively limited resources, provided there's good, smart thinking, and importantly, local government that can respond to citizens' needs.
I think you've already mentioned bad governance, lack of resources, etc., and I wanted to delve more deeper into that. In terms of facing these challenges, I'm a policy student and I study a lot about this idea of a welfare mix, where you have a relative role that the government, the state plays, that you already mentioned in providing important services to people who live in cities, and a role that companies and the market also plays, and a different role that the civil sector plays in also tackling society's important issues. So could you shed more light on that? What critical role in the next few years that you think the government needs to play, and what the people need to do as well, and the role that companies need to play, each in tackling this really difficult challenge of reforming our cities?
Cities have always been under threat from the trading class. The trading class, to be very simplistic, has a habit of encroaching into a city. And it's throughout history, in our religion even. Do remember that Jesus Christ was executed after he protested fellow Jews committing commerce in the house of God on a holy day. Again, traders entering into a sacred place within a city, encroaching upon it. So it's even in our biblical past. And the same is true with cities nowadays. Cities are places at the end of the day that produce GDP. Most of the world's GDP comes from urban areas. And so cities are incredible places where resources are consumed. Finances are also centralized. So the corporate world lives in cities, in other words. And they control the flow of goods and services in and out of cities, and through that, their global empires. And it's this extraction of resources sometimes that comes at a cost of what happens in cities. If corporations aren't sensitive to the environment and to the people that live in cities, they can lose them. So for example, let's take a Pakistani city, where Gujranwala, for instance. I know many people in Gujranwala who've done fantastically well in the steel business, but the minute they make a bit of money, they relocate their entire family to Lahore, which is about an hour away, mostly because there aren't any good schools. And there's not enough clean drinking water. So if a city can't provide these basic services, if the companies, the steel mills of Gujranwala can't ensure clean drinking water as a result of their factory outputs, they're going to lose the very people who invest in their city. See what I mean? So it's very important for corporations to be incredibly sensitive to the pollution that they cause, because they have historically been responsible for the pollution that exists in cities. And there comes the role of the government. The government is the arbiter of rights between the citizens and corporations and industry. It's the arbiter of the right of a clean and healthy environment, and also the right to trade, commerce, and industry. And so the responsibility of the state or the government is to be able to set up rules of what people can do and what citizens can expect. So citizens should expect clean air. Citizens should expect clean drinking water. And the rules should be such that corporations shouldn't be allowed to do anything that makes the air dirty or the water polluted. So that's the role of government. Civil society here is crucially important, because quite often I'm told in Pakistan how environmental concerns that I fight and argue about are elite political dreams, something that only developed countries, once they're rich enough, can actually start targeting. But this is not the case. This is absolutely not the case historically. Historically, wherever corporations throughout the world, throughout history since the Industrial Revolution, have committed immense environmental crimes until civil society stood up and said, no, that's enough, no more. And so you have cases and incidences in Europe, in Switzerland, where chemical companies were dumping chemicals into the various rivers until civil society protested and said no. And that's where environmental regulation of waters came from in the 1800s and 1900s. And in most cases, civil society was very aptly represented by mothers concerned about their children. And so the story of environmental sensitivity and the development of environmental law is not the result of economic development, but of the consistent struggle of civil society against corporations and industries who have been polluting without accountability.
Which you've largely explained what our next question was about. But essentially, what I wanted to ask you now was, as someone who doesn't know much about legal affairs and regulation, but cares a lot about climate change, Could you explain to me more about the role that regulation plays in environmental concerns?
We have environmental laws in Pakistan that were framed in 1997 and are still in our statute books without many major amendments. So our environmental laws are well over 20 years old. They are what you can broadly classify as first generation environmental laws, which treat environmental infractions as crimes that must be punished. So they're very much focused on what we call end of the pipe pollution. So what's coming out of the tailpipe, or what's coming out of your chimney, or what you're throwing into a water body. And it punishes anything that pollutes these things with fines and imprisonment. So it's end of the pipe and very carrot and stick type of approach to environmental regulation. But Pakistan is not the only country to have experimented with environmental law, and not the only country to have found that such end of the pipe, carrot and stick mechanisms aren't very business friendly. Because what winds up happening with this type of framework, first generation environmental laws, is you wind up shutting down industry and basically upsetting industrialists and upsetting the apple cart. What environmentalists and lawyers have since found is that a second generation of environmental law can be conceived where economic tools can be used to provide stimulus and incentives to industry to improve their processes and clean up their act, so to speak. So you have things like tax rebates, tax incentives, and government grants to industries that can comply with certain environmental standards. So that's a second generation of environmental law. And then a third generation of environmental law is really when environmental concerns are mainstreamed into broader economic development policies or financial policies. Take the case of China, for instance, which in the 1980s discovered that its unit cost per GDP was multiples of what it took a unit to be produced of GDP in OECD countries. In other words, you know, just to produce a brick, there was so many resources, so many more resources that were being consumed in China than were being consumed in Western countries producing the same thing. And so the Chinese government decided upon a economic policy that incorporated reduction, recycling, and reuse, the three R's, and introduced a term of circular economies, where all sorts of products would be produced, but their recycled goods would also be informed, or recycled goods and waste would also form parts of other products in the economy. Everything would be recycled, reused, or reduced in its consumption. And that's really the third generation that some countries are looking towards. So when I look at environmental law in Pakistan, I see the difficulty we have over here, because we're basically trying to shut down businesses. And businesses react very violently to this. There are all sorts of legal challenges, and that is the history of environmental law in Pakistan, these small industrial concerns being shut down and then being adjudicated by the High Court as to whether or not they've met environmental standards. So we're ripe for a transformation into the second generation, and hopefully we can mainstream environmental concerns into broader economic thinking with a third generation iteration of environmental law.
Expanding that third generation stage that you're talking about, where you take environmental law and concerns and you put them at the center of your economic and social policy making. Can you tell us more about that? What implications do you think environmental concerns have? How do they tie with other important policies that Pakistan has to make in the future? For instance, our education policy, our health policy, poverty alleviation programs, our tourism. Where does environment fall into this whole mix, and where should it fall into this whole mix in the future?
Well, I suppose one way of answering that question is by looking at industries in particular, because no two industry pollutes exactly the same. You know, the sugar industry works differently. Its effluent is different from, say, cement plants, which burn coal and pollute the air. So it's completely different. But in terms of Pakistan, I think the place to start would really be a thorough analysis of the current health risks and ecological risks associated with the prevailing atmospheric and water pollution. So we'd find, for example, that life expectancy because of air pollution is reduced by about 2 years on average in Pakistani cities and goes up to as much as 5 years in Lahore, for example. And you'd have to ask yourself, all right, we need to improve the air quality. How do we do that? Where does the air pollution come from? We're informed by a study that was conducted by the government of Punjab that about 45% of the air pollution in Punjab comes from the transport sector because of the poor quality fuels that we use, and about 20% each comes from the industrial sector and from energy production. So if you want to improve air quality and improve people's health, then you'd have to change the fuels in Pakistan. You'd have to also change the type of fuels industry uses to power itself, and also the types of thermal and coal-fired power generation plants that we have in our energy sector. So all of a sudden, environmentalism becomes better oil refineries, renewable energy, and sustainable electricity and industry. So that's how looking at just one issue can translate to environmental regulation in three others. And you can break this down into different other industries as well. You can break it down to the sugar industry or the leather industry because they pollute water. And then you can look at how, you know, water treatment can be prioritized as well.
Perfect. That was also what our next question was about. I just wanted to delve more deeply into Lahore because Lahore's air currently is one of the worst in the world to breathe in. And whenever I think about Lahore's toxic air, I think that not enough people talk about it. And I think that essentially what happens is that whenever things get really bad and people start getting sick and you can't see anything anymore, that's when the government gets alerted and then it tries to put in whatever protective measures that it can. They've, for instance, put a ban on brick kilns recently. But I wanted to talk more about what a more sustainable approach to dealing with this crisis is and what precautionary measures and corrective measures can the government take and the government has to take now to correct this toxic air pollution situation in a more long-term manner.
Well, you know, let's start by your observation about Lahore being one of the dirtiest, most polluted cities in the world in terms of air pollution. And that's that ranking came about since 2017 when a bunch of people basically bought some monitors. These monitors gave us eyes and numbers to recognize that something was going on in Lahore. And it was in 2017 when this meter was installed and it started giving readings that then when newspapers started reporting on the issue. And it was in 2017 and 18 that not just domestic newspapers, but like the New York Times, the Guardian, the Associated French Press, they all wrote about air pollution in Lahore because we had machines now. The government of Punjab has a total of 5 air quality monitors for all of Punjab. There are 36 districts in Punjab, right? 5 monitors aren't even enough to measure the air quality effectively for a city as large as Lahore. You need dozens of them. And you need them not just in Lahore, you need them in other cities as well. Because I assure you, if you go to Gujranwala and set up some meters over there, it's going to be probably, if not worse than Lahore, as bad as Lahore. And so I keep on reminding people that it's not really Lahore smog. It's Lahore smog because we have machines here. It's really a Punjab problem. It's a regional problem because air quality is an issue from Kabul to Calcutta. It's a North Indian sort of Gangetic plain issue. And it's a regional issue. And so when you recognize this, there are a number of domestic and bilateral and regional steps that have to be taken to address air quality. And I think most broadly at the regional level, there has to be acceptance that this is a problem. But the politics here in Punjab on air quality are very much that the private air monitors are not reliable and only the government of Punjab machines give you the proper readings. And the government of Punjab machines keep on telling you the air quality is fine. So the government itself is denying how bad the air quality is. It's sort of rubbishing the effectiveness of these air quality meters. And that sends a huge disservice to the public who then remain uninformed about how poor the air quality is and can't make any rational decisions themselves about how to protect themselves. So one of the first things we need to do in order to deal with air pollution, not just in Lahore, but Punjab, Pakistan, is we have to invest in air quality monitors that tell us how bad the air pollution is. And through analysis of their data, we'll be able to know where the air pollution comes from, what's called source apportionment. A good source apportionment study will be able to tell us what sectors are causing the air pollution. The study that I mentioned a few minutes ago, the government of Punjab study that said nearly 45% of air pollution comes from automobiles, was a study conducted in 2018 only in 11 of the 36 districts of Punjab. It's not a comprehensive study. And I'm sure if you were to do a proper comprehensive study here just in Lahore, you'd find other sources of air pollution other than transport, energy, and the industrial sector. There's energy that's used for domestic cooking that also causes pollution, which isn't even measured. So once you have the proper metering network out, you'll understand where the air pollution is coming from, and then you'll be able to take adequate measures about it. Because it's not enough to blame India for air pollution when in fact the problem is coming from your industry. You know, you'll set up your policy response completely incorrectly if you don't have the proper data. So that's step number one. We need meters. That said, we're not complete nincompoops, and it's not like we don't know what's going on. The Government of Punjab study is a good indicator of where the culprits of air pollution are. Yes, it's the transport sector. Yes, it's the energy sector. Yes, it's the industrial sector. And yes, it's things like seasonal crop burning and also the brick kilns. So all of these things have to be taken into account. And you can't just focus on brick kilns and stubble burning and not focus on the energy sector and the transport sector. Your response has to be holistic. What the government of Punjab is doing is it's focusing on the brick kilns and hoping to convert them to what's called zigzag brick technology. And it's focusing on the crop burning by arresting people guilty of burning their crops, whether it's daytime or nighttime. The federal government, for its part, has introduced something called the electric vehicle policy, which seeks to make Pakistan a regional manufacturing hub for electric vehicles, thereby reducing the amount of oil we import for their consumption in Pakistan, also then easing our dollar outflows, but also thereby improving the air quality in our cities by replacing the stock of combustion engine automobiles with electric vehicles in the long term. This is a very ambitious policy. The government, the federal government has also introduced the import of Euro 5 fuels into Pakistan as of this December, and of June next year, we'll be getting Euro 5 diesels as well. This is a huge step up from the barely Euro 2 fuels that were being imported into Pakistan, which have an incredibly high sulfur content and are very, very bad for air pollution. So the import of these Euro 5 fuels ought to improve emissions from automobiles, provided that they are made mandatory, because currently other fuel qualities are also available in Pakistan. And also if the automobiles themselves are subjected to regular, what the British call MOTs or vehicle inspections, because it's no good getting Euro 5 petrols and putting them into a 45-year-old Bedford truck and running it uphill through the Potohar Plateau. It's going to amount to the same amount of air pollution. So even though these two initiatives that the federal government have taken are ambitious and good, there are certain stumbling blocks that have to be overcome for them really to give fruit.
That was very informative. We're going to wrap up now. And to end this discussion, I'd like to invite you to share some closing remarks that you may have for young people like myself who are studying in universities abroad or locally, who may be listening to this podcast and may want to contribute to this sector, or essentially will be responsible for Pakistan's cities in the future.
Anything? Yes. I want to caution everyone about the climate crisis, because it will be the defining challenge of yours and other future generations. I'm on the cusp. It's not really the defining challenge yet of mine, but it will be yours because the climate crisis is upon us. Everyone has to fight this. And it is beyond individual capacities to do so. Climate change can't be fought by turning the tap off when you brush your teeth or entirely by going vegetarian, because you have to understand climate change. We're here with the Arctic on fire, not because of personal actions, but because there are systems at play. And it's challenging these systems and dismantling them that would be the challenge of your generation. In my opinion, there are four major systems. There might be more as well. But these systems are, and I'll explain them, capitalism, patriarchy, consumerism, and the fossil fuel economy. You see, capitalism allows for the extraction of resources without any accountability. I'm not talking capitalism versus Marxism. I'm talking capitalism as a means of consuming resources. It's things like capitalism that throw up anomalies, like the fact that there are only 90 companies responsible for as much as 2/3 of all greenhouse gas emissions. That's the type of accountability, lack of accountability capitalism has allowed, resulting in a very small number of people responsible, well, first of all, very wealthy people responsible for the destruction of the planet. Then we have patriarchy, where man is at the center of the system, creating a systematic discrimination against women. I'm not talking feminism. I'm putting this aside for a second. I do recognize the systemic inequality, but please recognize patriarchy is a system of consuming resources because it's the man making decisions about everything, about what is to be done. And we have to dismantle this system as well. We have to get women into the rooms where decisions are being made. That'll be one way of dismantling those systems of capitalism and consumerism. And consumerism, there's no need for me sitting in Lahore to have avocado on toast. The fact that it has to be flown in from Dubai brings in a huge carbon trail. These are not habits that should be encouraged, nor should anyone think that they need to grow up to become a billionaire or have a private yacht or a private island. These are consumptive habits that we must give up, because consumption is one of the systems that's driving climate change. And all of this is based on the fossil fuel economy. You know, the coffee that I have given up because I recognize that it's flown in, comes flown in on an aircraft that's burning fossil fuels. Most of the world's goods are traded on ships that burn some of the dirtiest types of furnace oil on the planet. So we have to change these systems. We have to challenge these systems. And this would be my lesson, my you know, big bit of advice to you, that focus on these systems, challenge them, and do recognize that it's the generations above you who have made mistakes. And don't let them go just because they say sorry. Really hold them accountable for their decision.
Right. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Rafe. And it was really such a pleasure to talk to you about the climate in Pakistan, matters that are close to my heart and your heart as well. And I really learned so much. So thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me. And best of luck with your podcast series.
Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed listening to our discussion. This week, I sat down with Ahmed Rafe Alam, an environmental lawyer and climate activist based in Pakistan, to explore the environmental concerns plaguing the major cities of the country and the role that young people must play in combating Pakistan's climate crisis. The music for this episode is Lyra Marches by the Tamash Beans. This is your host Vinay Kram signing off. To hear more from the Beaver Sound, subscribe to us on Spotify.